Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. This is our weekend podcast. And just a quick note, sometime in the last 24 hours, we passed 14 million total downloads since we began this. So thank you to all of you who have listened. Thank you to all of our guests and everybody who has participated. We really appreciate that. I also get a lot of emails based on things that we write about in our newsletters. And I got an email the other day from somebody who said, you know, you use the term woke way too much. So my recommendation is you stop using the word woke. So in case you haven't noticed, we're somewhat contrarian. We may be contrarian conservatives. So I decided to basically devote the entire podcast to the problem of wokeness and what's going on in the world. And who better to talk to about that than Andrew Sullivan of New York Magazine, who joins us on the weekend podcast. Good to talk with you, Andrew.
Great to talk to you, Charlie, and congrats on the Bulwark's incredible success. It's really wonderful.
Well, thank you. You know, you probably don't remember this, but you and I spoke once back in the distant mists of time, probably in the 1990s, and wow. When I was on a conservative talk show, and I can't remember what the I can't remember what the specific topic was, but I remember introducing you as a gay Catholic conservative. So I guess I want to catch up. Like, how do you describe yourself politically these days?
Oh, you know, I decided a long time ago that I would, because I was, as far as I understood, a small C conservative. And this is not something I just randomly decided to call myself. It's something I studied quite hard and thought about a lot. Went to grad school, did a PhD in the philosophy of Michael Oakeshott, a very distinguished and probably one of the finest conservative minds of the last century. And I have a thought out understanding of what conservatism is. I wrote this book, The Conservative Soul, mm-hmm. because I was exhausted by explaining this to people. And I thought, well, I can send them to this book and they can see where I'm at. So I consider myself the same thing. I haven't really changed at all. I'm obviously still gay. I'm not going to church right now, but that's because no one can. But I would definitely say that I still have faith. It's not an easy journey, and it comes and goes, to be honest. But my attachment to Catholicism is deep. So I don't know what else to say.
Well,
I've reacted over the years to various events from that rather parish of one kind of approach, and it hasn't really pleased anybody in the end. But it's who I am, and it's sincerely held.
Well, the reason I asked is because I'm occasionally asked how I describe myself, and of course I use the snarky contrarian conservative. But part of the reason I wrestle with that is I'm not sure what the word conservatism means anymore. Particularly in the age of Trump, does it mean small government conservatism? Is it part of the tradition of Edmund Burke, or is it something completely different? And I don't know, because when you say I am a conservative, there was a time when you were buying into a pretty clear set of principles and attitudes, and I'm not sure that's true. So I didn't mean to put you on the spot there.
No, please do. Being put on the spot is part of how we figure life out. In the book I wrote, I tried to take it back a couple of steps. So there's not a lot of policy in the book because I wanted to talk about the conservative temperament, the conservative character, as it were. And I do think that from my point of view, what I try to do is ground it in a certain level of humility, in the basic belief that we don't know much. And that conservatives acknowledge that more readily than other people, at least in the tradition I'm talking of, want to deal with fact and reality and empiricism, do not want to impose some utopian idea of the world onto society, which doesn't seem to want to evolve in that way. And that, yes, because of that, it tends to have small government. Because of that, it's also protective. And this is where Oakeshott really came in to me. It's protective of where we are. It's protective of the present, in as much as the present is an accumulation of the past. And in this case, it seems to me that liberal democracy is what conservatives are defending and trying to conserve. That our job as conservatives is to protect this rather precious and fragile and vulnerable society in which individuals are the prime actors, in which freedom endures, in which societies can evolve their own accord, and in which fanatics are kept from power. So obviously, at this point, I don't regard the GOP as a conservative force at all. And paradoxically, I did think that Obama was actually a force for small-C conservatism. No one really here believed me, but that I've been consistent on this for quite a while, and maybe it's because I'm English, so I come from a very distinct English tradition of conservatism that is really more Oakeshott than Burke, actually, although Burke is definitely part of it. And I think in America, where I wasn't born, I came here when I was just 21. It can be a helpful rubric to understand what's going on.
It strikes me that one of the markers of small C conservatism is humility, as you've described it, but also that it is very much part of the liberal tradition, as you mentioned, the small liberal tradition. And I noticed you've been writing a lot about illiberalism lately.
Yeah. Andrew.
So let's just define our terms before we get into this, because there's a lot going on right now. So how do you define illiberalism?
Well, I think it's human nature is how I would describe illiberalism. It's what we are by default. It is full of passion and full of force and authority. And certainty. And in contrast to that, liberalism is a very rare experiment in human history where government is actually explicitly limited in its power to do anything, which values the individual and his or her uniqueness, and that tries to create a way of life which is as free as possible for individuals to interact with each other and to create a society that means something for them. And less government, the more the society can breathe and evolve and become more fully itself. So that's liberalism. It is a decision that this person that you know is evil actually deserves a fair trial. It is the understanding this person who's saying something that you absolutely despise nonetheless should be respected and allowed to say it. It's innocent before being found guilty. It is all these very, in some ways, unnatural and counterintuitive processes and rules to make sure that our society allows for people to be free and with order. And that's really the key part that I think that liberalism is about. And I think be a conservative liberal, and I think you can be a lefty liberal, but your basic presumption that we live in a free society, that everybody's equal, that we all can discuss things, that we can debate them, and we can have procedures to make sure we don't rush to judgment. That's liberalism. And that's why you can see why this moment in particular, that is at its weakest point in my lifetime.
Sure, because it requires, as we mentioned, humility, restraint, and tolerance. So that's diametrically opposed to the cancel culture, or the cancel culture is diametrically opposed to the liberal sensibility. Now, what I think is striking, and I know you've really been writing about this over the last several weeks, has been the way that cancel culture, which sometimes called wokeness, has seeped out from some of the fruitier realms of academia into the mainstream of society, including in the media, in a very, very disturbing way.
Yes, and I think the key to understanding its illiberalism is understanding its philosophical roots. And the roots will tell us if you pursue them, and I think most people don't, and they don't realize where this is coming from, how philosophically it is actually designed to dismantle liberal democracy. Yeah. It does not believe that in the myth of individual freedom. It doesn't believe really in historical contingency. It doesn't believe in the possibility of an open discourse. And the reason it doesn't is because it believes everything is about power and that everything in our society can be understood best by the fight for power among various groups. In the past, of course, Marxism had this structure in which it talked about the structural war of the bourgeoisie and the proletariat and so on and so forth. This is more replacing that with various racial groupings, sexual and emotional groupings, and God knows what else. There's a long alphabet to be added to the people who have to be protected in this way. So that's why I think we're in an illiberal moment. And also because on the other side, with Trump, there is an absolute contempt for liberal procedures, for the rule of law, for actually sticking with the norms of liberal democracy, for not claiming you can do everything, for perfect certainty when he doesn't know what on earth he's talking about. And so there's illiberalism on the right and the left, and those of us in the middle have less and less oxygen to breathe.
Well, that's an interesting way of putting it, because I do feel that you're being squeezed if you try to have a variety of heterodox opinions. So let's talk about a couple of examples. Your colleague at the New York Magazine, Jonathan Chait, wrote about this. 28-year-old data scientist who's fired for tweeting out an article suggesting that rioting might be politically counterproductive. A study that said, you know, in the areas where there were riots back in the 1960s, that, you know, 2-point advantage to a candidate like Richard Nixon, places where there were peaceful protests, was much more politically effective. And the guy was fired for tweeting this out. This is kind of a scary moment. How does this happen?
It is. I mean, yeah. Because the point is that it doesn't, that he did that scholarship in good faith, right? And it, maybe you disagree with it, but the idea that someone should be fired for doing scholarship in good faith is truly disturbing. The reason they're firing him is because they don't really believe, as I said, in the principles of liberalism, which is that ideas can compete in the marketplace and no one's the poorer for it. No one's physically harmed or psychologically damaged by listening to an argument that disagrees with them. And so what you have is this vengeance against people thinking for themselves. And it's enabled by Twitter, of course, because Twitter is a mob. And if you want to get someone, it always helps to get the mob baying behind you and to create an atmosphere of moral panic. And I think this is also something deep in America. You know, this is the country, not just of individual freedom, but of the Scarlet Letter and the Blacklist, the Hollywood Blacklist, and McCarthyism. Mm-hmm. This is a country that has, and go back to Salem, to the Puritans, this country, or Prohibition for that matter, this country has a streak of real puritanical intolerance from its very beginning. And I think this is partly a manifestation of that. It's also becoming more like a moral panic, in which this incredibly crude idea that America is basically a white supremacy, always has been, always will be, is the overall truth of our lives, and everything must be filtered through that.
Take an example of this. There was a tweet recently from Black Lives Matter that when you expose a racist student, you stop them from attending a university that will allow them to become a racist healthcare worker, teacher, lawyer, real estate developer, politician, etc. And you tweeted that this is beyond chilling. It's the logic of purges and cultural revolution and mob justice. It has more than 400,000 likes. Liberal democracy is extinct. Yeah. So this is what you're talking about here, isn't it?
Yes. It's a spirit. There's a spirit of liberalism that this is utterly opposed to. It really wants to impose uniformity because it believes that if it doesn't, people will be harmed. They even say lives will be lost. People's existence will be erased. All these incredible hyperboles that they use. And they really do believe that speech, and they say this explicitly, is a form of violence. So that saying something that people disagree with is the equivalent of hitting them, then you also get this extra twist, which says that white silence is violence. So you can't even keep quiet. You can't even just bide your time as a citizen. You have to proactively put up there your fealty to the cause. You have to put that black square on your Instagram. You have to, every company has to put out this statement about why they take all this seriously, and they come up with the same rhetoric and language that comes out of critical race theory and out of the diversity industry. And obviously, people's ability to think for themselves and to engage in debate is chilled horribly. The number of people, I mean, I get swarmed with hate on Twitter, but the number of people who then privately say, I'm glad you're sticking up. I can't say these things. I can't say these things because if I did express my opinion, I would probably lose my job. I would be marginalized and stigmatized in the company or fired, you know, like James Damore was, for having a simple, rational, reasonable conversation about gender difference. This is
so what? Yeah,
this is totalitarian, Charlie. It's not the real underlying liberal spirit of America.
What do you think about what happened at the New York Times, which famously ran that op-ed by Tom Cotton? It was a revolt of the staff who felt that running that made them feel unsafe, and it ultimately cost the top two op-ed editors at the New York Times their jobs. It was kind of a remarkable moment. So what was your take on what's happening at the Times? Is this a manifestation of what we're talking about?
Yes, of course it is. And a critical mass of people who are opposed to liberal values have essentially, I think, leveraged emotional and moral blackmail on their supervisors, their editors, the people who have been editing the New York Times for so long, using this incredibly crude language out of critical theory. And for me, to see someone like James Bennett, who I will fully disclose has been a good friend of mine for many, many years. We started out together at New Republic. We worked at The Atlantic together. I know him very well, and he is the most principled, decent person I know in journalism. He was only trying to foster, on that op-ed page, a diversity of views. He has, I think, pretty much failed, because most of it is unbelievably tediously uniform in its beliefs now, that op-ed page. It is. I mean, the thing about the woke columnists of every different shade and hue and variety is that they're all saying the same thing. And after a while, it's boring. It's just boring and tedious to read. So James was simply, I don't know this, I haven't spoken to him about this, but it seems to me James is just trying to do what every editor in history is always trying to do. Let's air some debate in our pages. Let's have someone who can reasonably support a position, which was that federal troops could be used to go in if the local authorities and police were unable to control rioting. I disagree with it, by the way. I didn't agree with Cotton. I don't agree with Cotton on many things. But it was a perfectly reasonable op-ed. Nothing outrageous in it. There was nothing untrue in it as such. But they have become so wedded to this ideology, the diversity of debate and opinion is something they specifically want to end.
And so, you know,
when I see a good liberal like James, I mean, James is he's liberal, incredibly liberal on race. He created the platform for Ta-Nehisi Coates, for example, to start his writing, and supported him and really helped make his career. And that he is basically derided as a white supremacist for running a sitting senator's op-ed is just bonkers. And the fact that Sulzberger caved to these people means that essentially they now have a veto over anything that goes into the New York Times. The new op-ed page editor put out a tweet saying, a memo saying, if you see anything you might object to, gives you the slightest pause in her words, call me immediately, email me, text me, make sure that stuff does not appear on our site. Well, what the hell is that?
Well, see, this is the thing. Is this a generational thing? Because I thought that was the point of writing controversial, provocative opinion pieces, that it should be designed to give people the slightest pause. So this is the new op-ed editor saying, this is a safe space.
Yes.
Really? The op-ed page where, and again, I think Barry Weiss, you know, called this out and said, you know, there's two different worldviews here. A lot of us simply assumed that a diversity of viewpoints was a good thing, that you countered a bad idea with a better idea, that you engaged in this sort of back and forth. But now there is this new mentality, which you're describing, which is, no, if there are words I disagree with, we don't have a dialogue. I just simply proclaim that I'm a victim here, that I feel unsafe. And heads will roll. And that yes, seemed to be, at least in this moment of, and I'm glad you used the term moral panic, one hopes that at the end of all this process, the calmer heads will prevail and go, okay, you can at the same time hold in your mind the idea that Tom Cotton is completely wrong and completely disagree with this, but also that it is not an act of violence to allow his opinion to be expressed.
Yes, and this has been, Charlie, a function of a new generation arriving in newsrooms. Function of another couple of things, which is that the internships at these places are, and they won't admit this, but it's very dominated by people from liberal elite colleges.
Mm-hmm.
Also, the economics of media meant that old farts like you and me were becoming too expensive for these new digital platforms to support. And therefore, there was a huge economic incentive to hire cheap, young, millennial writers. Now, they have come out of universities which have, in the liberal elite, completely saturated them in this ideology, down to their everyday actions, their thoughts, their words, their relationships, how they talk to one another, where they sit in the diet. All of this stuff has been saturated with these people. And they also got used to the idea that because their parents were spending so much money, they could tell the teachers really what to do and could whine at any moment in ways that my generation would never have dreamed of doing for any kind of thing they might object to. And shutting down speeches from other professors, ridding basically the curriculum of so much of what we understand to be the greatest and the best parts of Western civilization. And those people came into the media and immediately started to try and enforce the same rules that they had on campus on corporate America and in the newsroom specifically.
And so remarkably are succeeding.
They are succeeding. This has been a huge success for them this last week. You look at the bestseller lists and it's full of critical race theory and the people who are creating an industry of diversity industry to impose this new orthodoxy everywhere in corporate HR practices. I mean, that's the other thing. When you're a writer at a magazine and you disagree with another writer, in the old days, you might have a fight. You might have a beer. You mm-hmm. might just quip over your desks. You might even rib each other. But you sure as hell wouldn't immediately go to human resources and HR to get that person fired for having a wrong opinion because he's oppressing you with his ideas. I mean, Charlie, I sound like an old codger now, but I was always pretty young in journalism. But I just remember the days when journalism was a wild and wacky place where people tried things out. I mean, my old editor, Mike Kinsley at the New Republic, famously told me that if you think you've gone too far, you probably haven't gone far enough.
Yes, that was what good editors would tell you. By the way, just people can't see this, but this is a podcast, but I literally have my hands in my head in my hands right now going through all of this.
Oh, I know.
And, you
write it now because you won't have the balls to write it when you grow up.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you made an interesting... You made a key point before that a lot of this stuff is just incredibly tedious and boring. And I'm not sure that within the bubble they realize how tedious and boring it is, but also how the whole effect is to shut down debate. Because you look at it, at least I do, and say, you know, why bother to engage it? I think, you know, why go out there to engage it? Because, of course, if you do, this process that you're describing is taking place. I saw that you tweeted out an opinion piece from The Independent, where, and here's the tweet. You know which one I'm talking about here? The woke Mad Libs. This is, I'm not making this up. This is their tweet. Opinion: what the white supremacist roots of biological sex reveal about transphobic feminism. Okay. I will admit I was spared myself a click there.
Yeah.
And you know that there's probably some nugget of things, you know, yeah, you know, we do as a country need to address white supremacy, right? We do need to address some of this stuff. But a sentence like that is not written to persuade or inform, is it?
No, it's not. And it's philosophically coherent within its own worldview. And that's what I think many liberals, old school liberals, haven't grasped yet. That this is serious. This is an attempt philosophically to undermine liberalism at its core. This is, and it comes with a whole range of premises and philosophical ideas that were framed entirely in opposition to liberal democracy. And think of it as a mask for oppression. It's a fraud. As the New York Times Magazine 1619 edition said, our ideals were false. And I don't believe they were. I'm an immigrant. I don't believe they were. I think they were imperfectly realized. They were fatally undermined and betrayed by the poison of slavery. But that this country's story is one in which people have made enormous efforts to overcome that, not enough. But the idea that this is an unrelenting vision of white supremacy in America, a country that's seeking immigrants who are 82% non-white, that has a diversity of races that, unlike any other culture or country in history, that is diverse, in which women are making incredible strides, in which gay people are now fully integrated, in which we also have a thriving black middle and upper class. The idea that this is a manifestation of white supremacy is self-evidently absurd. It just wouldn't work that way if it were really a white supremacy. And I think that those words, which were really popularized by Ta-Nehisi Coates as a description of us, are deliberately distortive of the complexity of American history, the variety of actors within it, the influence of religion, economics, culture, that are independent of the racial question and that inform and interact with it. This is a complicated history, but I do think it's a history that is clearly, over time, as Barack Obama constantly told us, has enfolded more and more people in its promise of opportunity. I don't know what you want to call it. People, my peers laugh when I say that.
Really?
They mock it. That kind of naive Americanism is blind to racial oppression, it's blind to the subjugation of women, it's blind to heteronormativity, all of this stuff. I'm naive. But you know, maybe it takes an immigrant to be that naive. I believe in this stuff. That's why I'm here. And I cannot believe and do not believe this country is some kind of dark prison for people who are on the margins. It has work to do, everywhere does. But the progress that we have made is staggering, and perspective is necessary. And the other thing that is happening in these colleges is that they're not teaching them any real history. They're not teaching them about the accidents and contingencies and twists and turns and complexities of history. They're being told history through the rubric of this ideology in which everything is about racial groups, everything is about gender, everything is about power. Nothing is about freedom. Nothing is about the individual. Nothing is about freedom of religion. And that's what distresses me.
And that's another difference between, I think, liberalism and illiberalism, is that liberalism is comfortable with that complexity, with the messiness of life, is taking life as it is, as opposed to trying to impose some sort of dogmatic conformity or ideological test. Okay, so I should have gotten to this a little bit earlier. I you know, you're part of the story somewhat. What's happening with you, Andrew? And you feel free to not answer this question, but there was a piece in The Spectator, why isn't Andrew Sullivan allowed to write his column? And it mentioned what happened with Tom Cotton. And then it said the Maoists at New York Magazine, your employers, were going after their best columnist, Andrew Sullivan, suggesting that you weren't being allowed to write about some of the urban disturbances. Presumably, Sullivan's editors are frightened that he might make the radically bourgeois point that looting and violence are wrong. So is that true? What's going on?
Yeah, I tend to believe that if you work in a place, there is a distinction between your private communications, which should be confidential, and what you say publicly. It's just a question of professionalism and treating your fellows and colleagues and bosses with a certain amount of respect. Now, I'm a hot-blooded Irishman, so occasionally I'll spout out off, but at the same time, I don't want to talk about the internal doings of New York. But I will say that my column's running this week, I think people will see that it's not exactly pulling its punches, that my actual editors who are working with me have been spectacular, both in their support for me and in their really rigorous editing of my pieces to make them better. And I intend to stay, and I intend to keep writing. I'd be foolish to say that there hasn't been a sea change in journalism, in which, as I said earlier, a groundswell of staffers really don't believe in working with people they disagree with. In fact, they believe that it's some kind of threat to their existence and dignity and sense of who they are. And I don't know where we're going. It's not looking good. It's just not looking good. The number of dissenting voices or complicating voices in liberal media are getting fewer and further between. And so you see most of them defecting at some point to ostensibly and explicitly conservative media. But the old magazines, which used to have a more broader liberal perspective, I'm thinking like the old New Republic, which I was very proud to edit and be part of, they've disappeared. And so all the mainstream magazines, I mean, the New Yorker seems to me have gone completely woke. The New Republic, The Nation, Mother Jones, all those, even to some extent, The Atlantic, which is running stuff that really is overwhelmingly pro-woke. And I'm proud to be in a place where I work with John Chait, who's a real liberal. He's a Democrat in a way that I'm not, and he's a lefty in a way that I'm not, but he's a liberal and he's happy to debate freely and with good humor and with a certain amount of irony and wit rather than screaming his head off that people need to be fired. So there are a few of us left, but it becomes harder and harder because it's just psychologically. I'm not whining. I've lived my whole life in this kind of controversy. And I don't think people can say I've been a snowflake about it. On The Dish, I would run the most brutal critiques of my own work and my own ideas. And I've openly confessed times when I'm wrong, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, I'm fortunate enough to not. We're
human beings, and we are subjected to the most brutal, relentless, vicious mischaracterization of who we are, what we believe in, and assaulted not for our wrong ideas, but for who we are and for our daring to be a little different than many of our peers. I mean, as a gay man, you know, I've always been proud of that and firm of that. But boy, the positions I've held have not made me popular among my own community and world in many respects. I'm not complaining, but I'm just saying that it becomes harder and harder with Twitter when they really do shower you with hatred and bully people. The stuff that Barry Weiss has been put through, or that someone like Katie Herzog has been put through, or that Jesse Sengel has been put through, is despicable. They're human beings. To have all their colleagues and their peers demonize them that way is to my mind, I literally cannot understand someone who has entered the world of journalism who wants to shut other writers up. It's just
that's the real paradox, isn't it? That these are people who chose to be in a profession in which it is about the exchange of ideas. It is about the search for truth, and to And this is the part that I find so extraordinary, because as you know, again, this sounds old school now, apparently, to debate back and forth, that's okay. No, even to have your ideas challenged, that's okay. But you're talking about something completely different. So who's the maddest at you, Andrew? Who hates you the most on Twitter? What?
Mainly the left right now.
Mainly, yeah.
But that's probably because the right has stopped reading me, because I was one of the earliest Never Trumpers, as it were, and have been quite passionately against him from the get-go. My whole life, I've had much more hatred from the left than from the right. I mean, when I broke with Bush and the war and torture and massive spending and all the things that I found, the certainty of Cheney, for example, or of Bush, that did not win me many friends and allies. However, in the Obama years, when I was for Obama, you know, all these lefties thought I was, even though my politics are exactly the same, and in fact, these lefties now agree with me that Obama was a relatively conservative president, they nonetheless despise me. And here's the thing. They didn't enter journalism. They didn't want to enter journalism. They wanted to enter activism. They believe their role is pursuing power, not exploring truth.
Yeah, that is a category shift.
And there is no truth, you see, Charlie. In this philosophy, the idea of an objective truth, even if you can't get there, even if you can't fully figure it out, we assume there's something called reality out there that we can base our judgments upon. These people do not believe in that. All they believe is that we have narratives about the way things are. And the important thing is merely to seek power to enforce your narrative, your truth. And they have pursued this strategy relentlessly, and they have now taken the citadels of liberal society in terms of journalism.
So one of the nastiest debates online, and I will confess that it's one of those where I look at it and go, I don't want to even get involved in it. I don't want to get in the middle of it. I don't even want to tweet about it, because it would bring down the wrath upon me. Is the fight over J.K. Rowling's and gender? I mean, she is what you are describing. Multiply it by 100, the attacks on her right now. So where do you come down on that?
I'm with
basically, what J.K. Rowling has taken the position that there is a biological. Well, you describe it better than I will. But she's being attacked by she's being attacked as transphobic, because she says that if you are a woman who transitions to be a man, you're still biologically a woman.
Yes, I mean, in many ways, this is the narcissism of small differences. I think both J.K. Rowling and, in my case, also I, are thoroughly and always been in favor of transgender people having equal rights, dignity, and respect. Absolutely. It would not occur to me not to use the pronouns he or she that such a person wanted, or to treat him or her in exactly the way that person wanted to be treated. This is not some kind of mental illness. It is not some kind of pose. For a very small number of people, and it is very rare, it's a real dilemma. And they really are, in their minds, the sex that they are not in their bodies. And therefore, they seek to alter their bodies, because the mind, essentially, is more important to their identity than their body, in their view. And I think that should be respected. I absolutely think that people should not be discriminated against for that. I think many people...
So where's the heresy? What is the heresy?
The heresy is saying, nonetheless, biological sex matters. A trans woman is not entirely interchangeable with a natal woman or a regular woman. That there are obvious differences. We can agree to overlook those differences in terms of our politics and our respect and our public behavior, but we are not going to be told that someone with a penis is a woman, or that a boy can have a period. We're not going there. We're not abolishing sex as a category. and let me put this from a gay point of view. If sex does not exist, then homosexuality doesn't either. Homosexuality is defined by me being attracted to another man, the same sex, homo, than a woman, the other sex. If there is no distinction between these two sexes, homosexuals cease to exist. And I think a lot of gay men have been carried along in this new movement, which is actually has a direct aim at their own identity and nature. I don't see why you can't just say, again, complexity. Yes, the mind is incredibly important with sex, but so is the body. So are chromosomes, so is biology. And in understanding a person, we have to take all of that into account. Also, the response of other people to account. So that there are many women who genuinely want to have spaces that where they feel completely safe from the threat of a male penis. Let's put it as bluntly as I can.
Yeah, that if I just simply say I identify as a woman and I want to, you know, go into a women's, you know, some private space, I still have the penis. I'm not a woman despite whatever I say.
And if you're a woman in a shelter because of domestic abuse, that can be hard. If you're in a prison and there is someone who is physiologically male with you, that can be difficult and hard. And there are compromises here, there are practical difficulties here. But really where I think Rowling and I simply draw the line and say we are not going to be made to say something we do not believe to be true. And the idea that sex, the chromosomes, the hormones, the processes in the womb, that these things do not determine us in a way is nonsense. And we remain in the real world. I mean, we remain in the world that let's face it. If you did a poll in this country and asked people whether a woman can have a penis, it would not be a close call. But we are being told that to say anything but that is bigotry. It's insane.
So for people who are not familiar with this controversy and may think I'm exaggerating it, I mean, because they think of, you know, J.K. Rowling as the author of Harry Potter, this is a major, I mean, she is being inundated with thousands, you put it in perspective, thousands, tens of thousands of hate tweets, people demanding that her books be, you know, removed. I even read a piece in the Washington Post that suggested that she just needs to put down the pen and shut up and just not talk about this anymore. And she's been rather aggressively, and I would say somewhat courageously, pushing back on this. So how big is this?
Well, it's getting bigger. It's embedded in this kind of ideology is embedded in the Equality Act, which Biden supports. And if the right were to really go there, it could definitely, I think, wound Biden. It definitely has, in Britain particularly, where it seems to be a much bigger issue, it has torn the Labour Party apart.
Okay, I'm not familiar. What is the Equality Bill? What that Biden supports?
Equality Act is the proposed act by sponsored by the Human Rights Campaign that would grant non-discrimination protections for gays and lesbians and transgender people in employment, housing, public accommodations, inserting those categories into the Civil Rights Act of 1964. What it does, however, when you look closely at it, is it subsumes sex into gender so that it actually removes the possibility of there being a public recognition of a difference between a trans woman and a woman, which could have some consequences. And that's why
the consequences that you've been describing, for example, a domestic violence shelter or prison. Or
sports, for example, where if you have grown up as a boy, say, and you're 15 and you decide you are actually a girl and you're on the running team, the girls' running team, and suddenly your team is winning everything. There's a lot of, obviously, pushback against that. That women are actually being squeezed out of sport in high schools because of trans girls who have and have had the benefit of the physiognomy of a male. And this was something that Martina Navratilova simply pointed out. This wasn't fair to have people who have been born as boys and had grown up with testosterone and that muscle structure and bones that way should be able to compete against a woman. And she, again, was derided and despised and attacked, deplatformed, canceled, et cetera, et cetera. Now, look, when Martina Navratilova, whose coach was transgender, who's openly lesbian, and J.K. Rowling, who until like 3 minutes ago was the wokest person on the planet, right?
Yes.
If these people are now the demons because they're just simply pointing out simple biological facts, then you just see how irrational and crazy this movement has become. And I'm worried, I think a lot of people are worried, that if they really do get political power, even though they have overwhelming cultural power, if they have political power, then I think things like religious freedom, things like freedom of speech, even though we have the First Amendment, will be thoroughly pressured and stifled.
Well, and this is one of the things that got Rowling involved was a woman who was fired for expressing this opinion about biological sex. And so it's not purely speculative. If you believe that speech is violence or somehow that it is beyond the pale, then you have, what does the cancel culture become when it gets power? So we could debate the merits of this issue all day long, but the phenomenon that you've been describing is anti-debate. No, we can't debate it. There are certain opinions that just must not be allowed to be expressed. And if they are, we're going to demonize that person no matter how successful they have been, no matter how supportive they have been, no matter how respected they have been. In some ways, making an example of Martina Navratilova or J.K. Rowling makes that point rather dramatically, right? If we can do this to them, don't you even think about stepping up and trying to dissent.
Right. And think of people without their power.
Yeah.
I mean, J.K. Rowling and Martina Navratilova cannot be hurt by these people. Which is why they alone are standing up. They aren't afraid. They have more money than God and they're legends for very different reasons.
It still takes moral courage though.
Yes, it does.
Yeah.
I do. I'm not dismissing their position. I'm just saying that I think of all the people who do not have that clout, who are being silenced, who are being intimidated, who are being told not to think what they say, not to say what they think. Journalism, I think of all those younger journalists who are essentially being told by the New York Times, if you have any ideological diversion from this particular set of ideas, we don't want you. How do you think a young non-leftist commissioning editor at the op-ed page now feels? Mm-hmm. And the message is sent loud and clear. Pursue these ideas at your peril. Not only will you not have a career, you may be stigmatized forever for something you didn't even say. It's mob mentality that I think we just have to resist. And it's easy to resist by getting incredibly angry back. And occasionally I've done that. But I think the key thing is to explain patiently the ideas behind this new attitude. It's not about being nice to people. It's not about being more inclusive to people. Liberalism can do that. It's not about airing debate. It is about policing people's ideas, stigmatizing people as beyond the pale, and exerting power to impose a narrative with no interest in what might be true or not. That is the key philosophical thrust of this movement. And I think a lot of people who are understandably horrified by police brutality or dismayed for very good reasons that we haven't made more progress should not be fooled into thinking that these people are actually liberals and actually want constructive reform, want to focus on specifics. They want some kind of revolution. And in our entire framework of thought, I mean, to give you one example, if you were to point out that science notes that there are powerful effects of chromosomes and hormones in determining a person's behavior, attitudes, and so on, they will come back and say, that's because science has been constructed by white supremacists to oppress. Science itself is a function of white supremacy. You may think that sounds ridiculous, but it is mainstream on campus. And that's why scientists are also being hounded. And that's why when you hear these Nature magazine, for example, or Science magazine, or many of these journals where people who are insisting upon biology are being fired, demoted, purged, and marginalized.
This is so bizarre. It's just a rejection of so much of the modern world through ideology. Well, Andrew Sullivan, keep speaking out. You know, don't let the bastards grind you down, which is sort of my personal motto. And I really appreciate you taking so much time to talk with us on the Bulwark Podcast about this.
You're most welcome. I'm very grateful to have it. I've been doing this kind of thing, standing up against these kinds of people for a very long time. So I'm used to it. You do get tired. You do get exhausted. And unless you have really good friends and a really good base emotionally and spiritually, it's hard to go through. And people aren't. People are failing to do so. But keep writing. Keep thinking.
Well, we will. Part of the exhaustion is you're fighting a two-front war, too. The yeah. illiberalism of the left versus the illiberalism of the right. And I don't think those fights are going to go away anytime soon. Anyway, thank you so much for all the time this weekend. I appreciate it.
You're so welcome, Charlie. Thanks a lot.
And thank you for listening to this special weekend edition of the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back on Monday, and we will do this all over again.